and welcome to ESG Legalities, brought to you by Sustainable Growth Voice in paid partnership with Burness Paul. I'm your host, Heather Dinwoodie, and in this special one-off episode, I'll be speaking with Stephen Stewart, Head of ESG at Burness Paul, and Lynn Gray, Head of Health, Safety and Corporate Crime. We'll be shedding light on the legal perspective of ESG, exploring the opportunities it holds, and explaining what success truly looks like in practice. Perhaps we could start maybe just if you took a couple of minutes each just to sort of introduce yourself. So, Stephen, I'll come to you first, if I may.
Yeah, I am a senior associate in the firm's planning and environment team and head up the firm's ESG offering. My practice spans kind of multiple sectors, including energy and housing. And from the environmental perspective, I act for clients in renewables and manufacturing and industrials, food and drink and quarrying and waste. I'm in my role as the head of ESG for the firm. I lead our ESG strategy group internally, which focuses on delivering the services to clients under the ESG umbrella and discussing with clients where they are on their ESG journey and how the firm can assist them with getting to the next stage.
Sounds like a lot of work, but quite interesting work as well, I imagine. And yourself, Lynn.
Hi, Heather. Thanks so much. And it's great to be here on the Sustainable Growth podcast today. I am a partner at Burness Paul and I lead our health, safety and corporate crime team, which means that a lot of the work that we do sits across all of the various pillars of ESG in relation to corporate compliance, because there's the consequences of wrongdoing or not complying with the law tend to sit with our team, but we help clients both stay compliant as well as helping them fix it when things go wrong. I also sit on our ESG strategy group along with Stephen, and we regularly work together. My clients span the whole array of our leading corporate clients that we have at Burness Paul. We have a core practice in energy, but as Stephen also said, you know, it can touch on everything from construction, food and drink, any of the big manufacturing production clients, really anything where there could be that health, safety or some sort of corporate compliance tends to come to my team.
Toes in several ponds then.
Very much.
We're talking today about ESG and your kind of perspective of that from a legal position. So I thought we'd dive in just by asking you both, sort of in your own words, how would you define sustainable growth and how do those ideas translate in the real world?
First of all, kind of point out that kind of gone are the days where sustainable growth was purely kind of measured in kind of the ethical standpoint. There's much more goes into that, and there's a lot of it is data driven now. By comparison to what it used to be, it's clear now that kind of businesses, customers and their employees and the public at large generally have an expectation that there will be more of a socially and environmentally aware and accountable business that they are either dealing with, employed with, etc. And as I kind of keep telling my colleagues and my clients, it's not just simply green growth that we're looking at. Obviously, from an environmental standpoint, I would love that to be the case, that it was all environmentally driven, but because that is my particular practice area. But yeah, it's much more about the societal impact as well, and you know, looking at what your impact is as a whole.
I mean, I'd agree with that, Heather. I think that if you look at what sustainable growth means, I mean, for something to be sustainable, it has to be repeatable. So you've got to be able to be doing something, you know, that is, it's almost sort of that living and breathing piece. And you can't get away from the ethical element of it, being responsible both, you know, to existing communities, but also future communities. You know, that's probably really what sustainable growth is about. But there's also the financial element to that, and you can't get away from that. Financial gain and growth will drive a lot of that. But to be sustainable, there has to be that sort of ethical tie-up. But it's a challenging time for businesses, you know, economically and fiscally. There's uncertainty, you know, impactful decisions need to be made. But You know, it requires risk evaluation across the different elements of the building. I mean, business, as Stephen said, you know, green growth is a huge area at the moment, but it cuts across much more than that if you want to be sustainable in the long term. And that might mean making hard decisions about where to allocate your resources and also even cost cutting. So it can be quite difficult. But to get that actual sustainable growth, you know, it's probably about the financial impact, but also that ethical and responsible piece in relation to the societal element, both now and in the future.
I think you touch on a very interesting point there, because the word sustainable, it's chucked around so often that you almost forget what it really means. But, you know, a key tenet is that it can sustain in the future. So you hear people discussing sort of this might be more sustainable than that. But when it comes down to repeatability, it's really either it is sustainable or it isn't.
Yeah.
So I suppose kind of expanding on that, what do you see as being the main drivers for integrating ESG into business operations?
It depends on both the industry, the size of the business, and place that the management team are on the journey, or the directors of the company. So when we first embarked on looking at ESG as a particular practice area, we're very much of the kind of mindset of we'll let this be client driven rather than, you know, us trying to impose a service line onto the clients. We'll do a client listening exercise and see what comes out. And it was quite clear that across the various sectors and across various clients that they were on completely opposite ends of the scale in terms of where they are on their journey. And some of them were just setting off, some of them were, you know, in the middle of the ocean already. And it was a particularly eye-opening exercise from that perspective. And again, like I say, the drivers were completely different. You know, I was reading very recently that Q1 of 2023 was the biggest quarter for shareholder activism, and I found that quite interesting. And although I haven't seen it particularly from our clients as a driver, then it just focuses everyone else's mind that maybe isn't under a mandatory reporting obligation that, you know, they aren't exempt from scrutiny on ESG matter or sustainability. So the journey can commence in many ways, but it's just, you know, the drivers can be from an internal perspective, being, you know, employees and how they see the company, I suppose, and whether or not it's a place that they want to work at, given their ESG credentials or operations. It can come from like those outside factors like I discussed. It can come from regulatory reporting. It can come from just purely, you know, being a mindful citizen and thinking, right, is our business future-proofing itself by not engaging with us now?
For us, you know, there's so many lawyers, obviously, in our firm and elsewhere that have different views on all of this. But for our mind, you know, there's the three pillars of ESG: environmental, social, and governance. You know, that is a real underpinning and something that really underpins and lays the foundation for sustainable growth, because it cuts across every aspect of the business. You know, they're big titles, but if you drill down, there's lots of constituent parts that make up environmental, social, and governance comprising ESG. And for any business, it's the need to have business practices which respect ethical values, respect environmental considerations and also economic values, but that they also comply with the law. And that's where the legal bit really comes in, because there is a bit of accountability and responsibility. We're all human. We're all complex creatures. Behaviour is driven by many different things, you know, whether that's, you know, financial gain, self-interest, whatever. However, at the end of the day, often what drives human behaviour is a requirement or mandating. And that's what we're seeing now. But ESG essentially enshrines all of that, and ultimately that compliance piece that sits underneath it. But the the main driver behind it is obviously to promote right behaviour, you know, good and right behaviour, which feeds into that sustainability question, which, as you say, Heather, can be quite esoteric, but, you know, it is about sustaining growth and being able to build on something for the future.
I suppose it really comes down to kind of a combination of just, you know, moral and ethical values, but then also sort of recognition of potential repercussions for not following along with everyone else, for bucking the trend and ignoring ESG and thinking you can get away with ignoring ESG. I'm very interested in sort of how Bernese Paul kind of works on this from a legal perspective. Could you maybe walk us through some of the trends you've been seeing, or perhaps give some examples of the work you've been doing?
Yeah, sure. Like I say, it's spanned quite a lot, and Lynn touched on this as well. The E, the S and the G spans quite a substantive amount of our service lines across the firm. So it is particularly difficult when a client comes to you and says, we just want to speak about ESG. And that focus lands on obviously me and Lynn to go and speak to them about the specifics of what they need. And in terms of our practice areas, we've brought them all together, I suppose, in the ESG service line as best as we can, in terms of fitting them into little silos. But like I say, when you're discussing them with clients, the focus tends to be, they think they're coming in to discuss one aspect of it, which tends to be environmental, but actually what they need sits within both governance and the social aspect of it. Particularly in the governance piece, clients are very, very focused on, how are we presenting the data that we've collected in the correct way. We've got masses of data that we can show that we're doing X, Y, and Z, and how do we display this in terms of meeting our requirements, and what does our corporate structure look like? What is it? How does it? Is our board sufficiently independent? Are there conflicts of interest? Do we have a responsible tax strategy? What's our stakeholder engagement like? Those kind of questions get flagged up on the social side, for example. Obviously, like health and safety, like Lynn's touched on already, a big factor within that. Certainly within European legislation, they are very, very focused on the kind of human rights factors within ESG, modern slavery, forced labour. You've also got the cybersecurity angle when you're dealing with large entities and what's their diversity and inclusion policies looking like. So we tackle these from a very kind of holistic point of view first, and then drill down into exactly what the clients really need. And that's kind of, it dovetails with our relationship with an ESG consultancy called Thrive, who basically can do a deep dive into the workings of the business and look at double materiality assessments and see where the client really, there's a lot of work goes into what they do, and usually that will throw up a particular or three key issues essentially in driving their ESG strategy forward. And that's where obviously we then can come on board and have a look at the particular legal aspects of those as well. So there's multiple touch points there, and like I say, no clients ever really the same, but in terms of trends, it really, I think when we first started off in this journey, it was very much environmentally driven, but certainly now the focus spans a lot wider than that. Like I say, the S is important, very important now, in terms of when clients are obviously a public facing entity, there's a lot of public scrutiny on them, but also the governance side is becoming very, very prevalent.
I would add to that, Stephen, just by saying that particularly probably in the last 12 months, you correct me if I'm wrong, but we're seeing more requests coming from the C-suite to us. So rather than us having to take things to the C-suite, they've obviously been listening, there's a lot of discussion around ESG generally, but we are seeing requests for support and advice coming from the C-suite. And I think I saw a statistic a while ago when we were, talking about this podcast, Heather, that 57% of the C-suite now have ESG as a top priority. But what does that actually mean? I think a lot of C-suites maybe don't know what that means. So, part of our role as legal advisors can even be in the horizon scanning piece to see where we can help unlock some of that potential around being compliant that may fit within one of the pillars of ESG and building on that. And it's gone way out with, you know, public companies. The drivers are probably different for public and private companies, but the ultimate goals, you know, end up being the same, whether it's in enhancing reputation, strengthening supply chains through compliance and transparency, tendering processes, you know, any of those aspects, including, you know, retaining and attracting talent to a business, but also investment, you know, for funders now, there's a huge drive on people being able to be both transparent and accountable in business on what they're doing and the decisions they're making. So for us as legal advisors, a lot of it is horizon scanning and listening to our clients and identifying where we can, you know, bring that growth to the table for them relating to the compliance with ESG.
I think that's interesting. You know, you're talking about kind of horizon scanning and all these new opportunities that can be found, whereas I suppose traditionally, and forgive me for saying it, but, you know, sort of getting lawyers involved might be something that's quite scary to businesses. They hear lawyers and they think, oh dear, that means trouble. So how are you working with companies to say sort of, this is an opportunity, this isn't something to be scared of? Or are you really finding that they're coming to you and saying sort of, signpost us to the opportunities, we know they're there, but we just need a little help along the way?
Yeah, that's exactly, I think that second point is exactly right. I mean, I think everyone, again, just harping back to when we first started off, I think there was a lot of kind of, there was an education piece that had to be done with, you know, both in the marketplace and with clients. And it wasn't just by the lawyers, you know, banks were involved, insurance companies. It's very much kind of driven towards, you know, making sure that business knew that it may well be regulated, you know, driven by regulation. It was also something that was an opportunity for businesses. And I think it's about asking the right questions of our clients to make sure that they understand that, like, what the opportunity is, and that, you know, it shouldn't be something that's taken as a scary and a large mountain to climb. And again, a lot of maybe general counsel within our clients were tasked with becoming the kind of head of ESG within their organisation and driving the kind of ESG agenda, because it seemed very regulatory driven, and, you know, it's quite a big undertaking to decide that, you know, on top of all your day to day legal work, you're then being asked to take on this role as well. But ultimately, the ESG remit sits within the whole organisation. It basically kind of is the building blocks of, you know, your corporate identity, both externally and internally. And a lot of our clients, when we discussed it with them, already were doing a lot of ESG related activity that they just had not identified yet. So, like you said in your question, it was very much a, right, actually, you think that you're at the start of the journey, but you're actually quite far in already, but you just haven't put those, you're joined those dots together and said, you know, and presented it in a way that you're looking at a kind of more holistic view of your organization rather than, you know, something that sits squarely within E, something that sits squarely within S and within G. It was kind of taking them on that journey to show them that, you know, you are already through your operations very much going through the kind of ESG process and are a sustainable business, but that you just haven't put it down on paper.
I would agree with that as well, but I think it, the approach that clients have had to take in terms of joining up those dots and addressing the silos is something that, you know, I think Bernice Paul, we can really play to our strengths because we all work together, you know, collaboration and that holistic approach that Stephen mentioned at the start is something that we are inherently strong at. And it means that, you know, we have that ability to see the bigger picture, and we've been able through, you know, the excellent partnership that we have with Thrive and other initiatives that we have to be really solutions focused for our clients and, you know, client centric, but being able to reflect the strengths that we've got across our organization, because from environmental to health and safety to corporate governance, employment law, immigration, you know, everything that's in between. You know, we have, you know, market leading lawyers in every aspect. We're able to bring that to our clients and help them drive that collaboration internally within their business and harness what they have, and reflect that under, you know, the ESG umbrella to any extent that they have to. And we can also make sure that they're one step ahead of the game. So they're ensuring compliance to provide that assurance in their business service, which drives the growth. And, you know, we can obviously help them if things go wrong. But ultimately, as you said, Heather, lawyers can often be a distressed purchase, and we don't want that if we can avoid it. Certainly our clients don't. So it's making sure that we achieve those best outcomes, which often is driving a compliance path rather than a reaction to something going wrong in the event of non-compliance.
It's actually really refreshing to talk about ESG in this way, because I think, you know, when the concept kind of first emerged, perhaps it was unpacked to that level, but then in more recent years, it seems like ESG just rolls off the tongue and is spouted about without anyone taking the time to consider what it means. But I mean, it's interesting what you say there, Stephen, about the fact that a lot of these things were already happening. You know, before there was ESG, there were good people in business, whether it was people who returned a good profit through excellent stakeholder management or people who cared about the environment. They were there and they were doing these things. It's just that we now have this concept which seems so big and scary, but really when you take it down by its elements, it's just basic good nature, frankly, as naive as that may sound, it really is, isn't it?
Yeah, good business practice, exactly. Yep.
And I mean, all of the elements really underpin the social license to operate, which, you know, businesses are, you know, struggling to deal with. And that is such an intangible concept in and of itself. But in theory, everything that we're talking about in relation to ESG from a legal aspect really underpins that social license to operate. And as you say, Heather, you know, that's been, you know, for as long as there's been business, you know, there's been people doing business the right way or the wrong way, whichever, you know, camp you may fall in, depending on your own personal opinion. But you know, I think in the past we've had CSR, you know, corporate social responsibility. I think that was a much wider and harder to define concept, whereas ESG, when you actually drill down, you can understand all of those constituent parts that may already be reflected in your business. And it lets you then manage any risks or any gaps by being able to identify the gaps. And, you know, we've certainly been working with clients in doing that, you know, looking to benchmark where they're at and where they want to get to, and building on, you know, sustainable growth so that they are future-proofed.
I mean, I'm not sure whether this falls into any sort of official definitions, but I tend to think of CSR as being a much more defence-led strategy. It was, you know, things coming in and people sort of throwing back their approach to a problem, whereas ESG does seem a lot more opportunity-focused, because it is about that growth aspect. It's about risk management for the future, essentially. So I wonder, maybe you could sort of expand a little bit on what successful ESG looks like to you. I think you discussed sort of five key areas that you would imagine as successful ESG.
You know, we've obviously spoken about this, and Stephen and I speak about this regularly. It's very important for us as lawyers to listen to our clients and to understand what success may look like for them, because you're not going to get one size fits all. But there are those key constituent parts that you mentioned, Heather, that are relevant, because, you know, when you're thinking about ESG, it's, you know, why would someone invest in you? Why would someone work for you? Why are you allowed to operate? How can you determine your impact on the environment? What are we doing as a business, and where are the gaps? And that's often really what's involved. But in terms of success and what that may look like, depending on the answers to those questions, it ultimately depends on having a robust governance strategy within the business with clear lines of reporting and accountability. And without that, it is harder to join those dots. So if you have a robust strategy and are able to answer those questions with the reporting lines and the governance in place behind that, it will ultimately, you know, bring out success. If there isn't that strategy with the framework behind it, it's a bit like a house of cards and it won't stand up. But certainly on the ESG piece, it works. And, you know, there's often really impressive things going on in businesses, and collaborating and bringing that all together and harnessing it is really quite exciting to see. And certainly as lawyers, it can give us some novel questions that we have to answer. But we are certainly seeing some success stories. And Stephen in particular has had some, you know, on the environmental side, getting to grips with a lot of the mandatory reporting pieces on that has been a challenge for some organisations. But, you know, we're a bit further down the line now on the journey, and it's certainly bearing fruit.
Yeah, certainly. Exactly that. I think that the wrapping their head around, I suppose, like I kind of mentioned at the start, but wrapping their head around like what they're reporting was going to have to look like in terms of from a regulatory standpoint is the key first step. And there's no getting away from the fact that good reporting starts with the good data. And I mentioned that right at the start. And it is a key factor for many businesses. It's how you gather the information that you need can often be a tough ask, especially, you know, if you're in an industry where you regularly, you know, cooperate with other organisations, and getting your information from your supply chain can be difficult depending on geographically where they're located. If you often have partnership-based enterprises where you're working in conjunction with other partners that are, you know, collecting their own data, and you're trying to present that as a jointly or separately, it can be quite a kind of daunting exercise, and any unreliable reporting can obviously expose companies to financial, regulatory and reputational risk as well. So it is a key thing to start thinking about right at the outset. And again, especially for, you know, clients that have kind of mandatory reporting obligations, then if it starts off wrong, it goes wrong pretty quickly. So that's not to kind of put the fear in anyone, because there are obviously ways in which you can manage that appropriately, and thinking about it early in terms of, you know, what your climate change disclosures are, what you have to disclose from a polluter point of view. Are you looking at biodiversity within your organisation? If you're a developer, or, you know, you maybe work offshore, or you're looking to get involved in renewables projects, that can be a kind of key driver from a not just from the regulatory standpoint for your reporting purposes, but for, you know, getting your development off the ground. And yeah, I would say that there will be more regulatory kind of mandatory reporting as we go along for like kind of smaller to medium sized enterprises as well. But it hasn't hit yet. But certainly for following the lead from Europe, in the UK, there will start being a drive as we get towards our kind of net zero targets, and towards making sure that all the reporting is accurate, and not just that, but you're benchmarking it, and there will be an expectation that the following year there will be an improvement as well. So yeah, getting all that stuff right in the first instance leads us on to, you know, start to expand our thinking, and not just looking at, you know, the environmental piece, but looking at the other areas of like ESG.
We're definitely moving away from, you know, the C-suite of any business being able to issue a high-minded statement or policy on a particular area and think that that's going to stand up to scrutiny. And as, you know, Stephen rightly said, the mandatory requirements and consequences, you know, the regulatory requirements and consequences are coming. And at the moment, that's obviously aimed at higher value businesses in the private sector. The public sector has probably been subject to greater regulation for a longer period of time, although possibly not the same, you know, enforcement aspect, but it is coming. And in addition to that, you know, so while we're having the accountability for businesses, there's also probably going to have to be a shift in the perception that individuals can hide behind the corporate decisions or the company or company policy, because a lot of the regulatory requirements are also coming with individual duties which bring with it individual liability if they're not complied with. And that's really for the decision makers and those with the control within the organisations that are affected. And that's not a new thing. A lot of the, you know, certainly in my area, health and safety, there's been, the regulators have had those tools for decades. They've not necessarily always been enforced, but with all the new legislation that's being enacted, wherever there's a corporate offence, there's always an offence that attaches to those decision makers or those with the control within the organisation. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, if enforcement follows and what that actually looks like. But certainly, you know, the stick is there, with the carrot being the compliance part and hopefully positive and sustainable growth as a result of all of that. But it's all tied up in the same thing.
I suppose as much as we try and focus on those carrots or on the opportunities of ESG, there are real trends there. There is mandatory reporting coming in. You know, it's taken quite a long time for climate-related disclosures to reach sort of the prevalent extent that they have. But now we've got nature-related disclosures coming in as well, and those are set to sort of take over pretty rapidly from what I can tell anyway. It seems to be sort of being adopted much more quickly. And you mentioned a few sort of considerations there in terms of the size of a business. So smaller businesses aren't quite having to report yet. And Stephen, you mentioned sort of geographical distribution as well. I wonder if you could touch maybe on sort of how different businesses are preparing depending on, yeah, on their size, on their location. What are these different trends you're seeing?
Well, particularly where we're dealing with entities that obviously in the UK who are trying to either procure services from parties you know, that are based in Europe, or they're selling their services to parties in Europe, there is a particular trend that they are seeing a ramp up in how much they are having to answer tender questions about their ESG credentials. And we are seeing a general trend towards these companies starting to come to us to ask for advice on how they would report it. And obviously, if you know they're a wholly UK-owned company, that we can deal with their management team, we'll work with them quite closely, we can look at what, do a competitor analysis to see what other people are doing. We can look at, you know, who their target clients are, and what their expectation level is, and you know, we can formulate a plan accordingly. Where there's like the fly in the ointment sometimes can be if the entity that you're advising is a subsidiary company to, you know, a larger parent based elsewhere, where they maybe aren't, they don't have as strict reporting requirements, so they're not as not as under as much pressure, I suppose, to disclose certain things, or maybe don't want to until they're mandated to do so. So there can be that kind of tension there between the kind of UK subsidiary and the parent company based elsewhere, where actually what they're coming to ask us is to formulate a strategy to push the ESG up the agenda within the parent company. It's a different way of approaching it for us, but it's just the need of the business at that particular time. They need to win more work, they need to demonstrate that they might be already performing very well from an ESG standpoint, but they need to get that strategy in place. They need to have it presented in a way that they can roll out to clients quickly and efficiently, and the data is obvious on the page that, you know, it works. And it's very difficult for them to do that when the data collection from isn't great, or the reporting style isn't great, or you know, the kind of other aspects of E&S aren't particularly a focus for their parent.
I think at the other end of the scale for the startups, it's more challenging, Heather, because, you know, if you're starting out or relatively new in business, you've got so many demands both on your time and on your money, in terms of your direction of travel and where you want to go, and have that growth piece. And I think, you know, the businesses that start out with the right mindset and, you know, prioritise the areas where they need to focus on compliance, it means they're in a much stronger position to achieve that growth and carry forward, at whatever time they might need that. Because, in my area, the principal part of my practice is health and safety. Now, if you don't have more than 5 employees, you don't need to have a written health and safety policy. But as soon as you have more than 5 employees, you need to have that. But a healthy and safety management system is so much more than just a policy. It has to be living and breathing. It's a dynamic document. That pretty much goes for any aspect of compliance that we could be talking about. And at different times, the need for a business, as it grows, will differ. And then some needs will be greater, some will be less. The most important thing is understanding what's important when, and making sure that you have the right, strategies in place to deal with that, including policies and procedures. And that's where the legal piece really comes in, because as lawyers, we can say to the clients, there's no legal requirement on you to do that now, so you don't need to have that, but it would be nice to have. But there will come a point, when you're tendering or when you're looking for investment in the business, that if you don't have that, it's going to be a big gap, and you're not going to be able to explain how you do business in a transparent, morally ethical way, as well as, bringing in the numbers. So it will put you in a weaker position. But, with the right type of advice, and it's not just financial advice, it really is legal, because there's a lot of mandatory requirements which are ever increasing. But they may only be triggered at certain points in a business's journey, but there may be some that they need to have right away. There may be some that they need to have depending on what stage they're at. And then there might be some that, they may can push to the future, but then if they don't have them, it's going to cause them a problem, whether that's investment, supply chain, regulatory, otherwise.
One of the key things, I think, and permeates right through what we've discussed, is, companies need to be dynamic with this, with the reporting strategy, or the ESG strategy in general, and adapt when these standards are updated. It's going to be a constantly moving target going forward, and they will adapt, they will change, the legislative pressure will be increased, and it's not something they can, they can report on once and think they can roll that out the following year and the next year after that. It really is something that, that's going to have to be a kind of dynamic change within the organisation.
I'm sure that's given our listeners a lot to think about. I mean, my main takeaways, I suppose, are that you've really got to roll with the punches on this. As you say, it's, this is coming, and the more you can stay ahead of it, the more opportunity you can take and the less fear you need to have. So thanks again to my guests for joining me today, and to our listeners for tuning in. If you've enjoyed this conversation, then be sure to visit our website for the latest news and analysis, subscribe to our weekly newsletter, and follow our feed for upcoming podcasts. All the links can be found in our show notes.